uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. It is Friday. Indeed, it is Friday.
It's motherfucking Friday!
Indeed, and thank you so much for being with us tonight. It is June the 22nd. Into Saturday, June the 23rd, 2012. We're going to be getting into a few news items for you here tonight on the show, as usual. And we'll be getting into our continued series of reading. And boy, last night, that was a humdinger, wasn't it? We had... and, you know, I wish there would have been more accuracy as to where the location of this... snakehead carving thing was in the wall, but there's, you know, like I said, there's been multiple stories of things. Supposedly somewhere there's some sort of letter or something they found etched into the wall too, like some kind of font. But again, that, you know, that's the whole purpose of this project is to, you know, if those things have been seen, if those things exist, then you know, they deserve to be found and documented. But at the same time, I don't want to go back and, you know, dig up something that's already been dug up and covered up again. I want to try to get some new data on some new locations. You know what I mean? So, yeah, as I was talking about last night, it's kind of a hell of a thing. But I do have one picture. But I don't know if this was, it may have been a structure that was, to me, I think it's a structure that was built way later, but it's like one of the arched walkways that they talked about has some kind of symbol on it. I've got a picture of it, but anyway, yeah, there was some good stuff. So we'll continue reading from that tonight as well for you here on the show. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. Bear with us right now. As we're making some changes, it's constantly changed about 100 times today alone because, man, Hydra's been working at it, and the guy who made it for us did some tweaks as well, and, man, it's really looking good now. It was looking good before, but, wow, now it's really starting to come together. I really like the way it looks, and I was talking about this with some of the guys in the chat room earlier. I think the background there definitely, I think, is definitely going to weed out some tourists. You know what I mean? Won't be any question anymore as to what kind of Moonbat shit you're getting yourself into when you come to my website. Yeah. It's just going to be right up front with it. You know, this is... don't even tread here if... you're not comfortable with the iconography of the website. But it is looking good, and thanks to both the gentleman who made the design for us and to Manhydra, our tireless webmaster, for continuing to, as I put it in the chat room, work on the website like it was his fucking master thesis. but his work has been, it's been fruitful because it looks, I think it looks killer. We also have our Kickstarter for the film up there at the website, Lost Secrets of Ancient America Part 1. We got the video from the Kickstarter page up there. You can actually get to the Kickstarter page from the video. If you push play there, it will come up with a screen. And when that screen comes up before it starts playing, there's a link. Or if you don't get to it that way, you can scroll down the page a little bit to where our shipping banners and stuff usually are. And, wow, the website looks doubled right now. Is that just me or? It looks like it's doubled, you know what I mean? Like you scroll down and like the website starts again. Must be an error, but he's probably working on it right now. I'm not bitching. I'm just saying. but anyway, I was just confused because I was scrolling down looking for the Kickstarter banner. There's a Kickstarter banner there now that's embedded underneath the regular operating cost banner. And that's where you find that for the Kickstarter thing. It's there. And that amount is everything. That's everything to complete the film, including distribution and all that stuff, and manufacturing of discs and getting it on online places such as Netflix and iTunes. So that's that's the total. There is what that is, and not only that, but like 500 or 600 of it, or maybe more than that, is going to go to fees. So I had to bump it up some to cover the fees. But anyway. There it is, and you can help us out and help us fund this project that way. And hopefully this is going to get it out to people outside of our zone. I think I only recognize maybe like one of the four pledges we've gotten so far. We've had $140 pledged so far. But again, you know, I don't see a dime of this unless it goes all the way. And, you know, we still have to pay our operating costs and everything else. So, you know, it's really up to you whether or not you want to use the Kickstarter thing or not. I'm really putting it out there for people outside of my specific pool of donators, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, you know, I think the best way for right now for you, the regular listener, to support my work and donate to my work is through my website and through my means. So, but you know, it's totally up to you. It's however you want to do it. Like I said, even if you pledge, you don't get charged that amount unless the whole thing meets its goal. You know what I mean? So it's not like it's coming out of your account right now to pledge, but I mean, it will come out eventually if the goal is met. So keep that in mind if you use that. So there it is. And we have the shipping banner right above that. And we have about 900 left on that. And, the bills are going to be due a week from today, and then 2 weeks from today is my birthday. Wow. Time flies. 2012 is flying by. I can't believe it's already almost my birthday again. But, there you go. That's how you can do that. So that's all up there on our newly redesigned Global Reality website, and hope you enjoy it. All the rest of my stuff is up there on the website as well. And thanks to everybody who has supported our film and our work to get us this far. We did come up short again. Like I said last night, anything that we can get in the immediate right now, interim between now and when this Kickstarter thing ends in July 21st, I think we came up maybe $2,000 shy. So, you know, even if we got 500 or another 1,000 in or something like that right now, that would keep me going until we know if this Kickstarter thing's going to come through. Because to be honest with you, if I stay on schedule and I stay to having a small, just a little bit budget to work with, I mean, like I said, I don't need much, but it makes a complete work stoppage. So that's what I'm trying to avoid. So what I'm going to do is, like I said, 500, 1,000, whatever. If you didn't support the emergency shipping banner and you can, or you did and you can again, you know, whatever, however we can do that, that can keep me working. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to be able to have a gigantic chunk of this film knocked out by the time that the Kickstarter thing ends in July. And then if we don't meet that goal, then I'll have a closer idea of what we need to finish it. But like I said, you know, so if I can stay on task and get another 500 or 1,000 in towards this film ASAP, we'll be doing just fine. We'll be able to stay on track. Like I said, I'm not going to be able to get it out when I wanted to, as early as I wanted to, but it's still going to be out. It's still going to be out this summer. I'm shooting for August, as early in August as possible. And like I said, then I want to spend the rest of that time, rest of the summer, promoting and get this film out in as big a way as I possibly can, and try to find people who want to come on board to get some digging going. You know what I'm saying? But right now, without further ado, it is time, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, indeed. You know what time it is. This is going to be a regular thing for us every week now. It's time for the Global Reality All-Stars. Yes, indeed, the Global Reality All-Stars is our new thing that we're doing with our supporters. A little give back and a little incentive for everybody out there. Every week on the last show of the week, whether that be on a Friday or whether it be earlier in the week, like a Thursday or something, we're going to be having our All-Stars of the Week announced. The All-Stars, how you get involved with this, if you donate $50 or more in a week, and you can donate more than that, but you can only get two entries into the contest per week. And at the end of the month, so that'll be next Friday night, we will have a drawing here on the broadcast. We will draw out one name out of the hat, and one name is going to get a special hand-selected gift from me, and it'll be, I'm not going to say we'll have some that maybe repeat, but it'll be different. It'll be mostly different from month to month, so. And last week we had a few, and this week we had somebody. It seems people seem to be hip to the idea. They seem to think it's a pretty good idea, and I'm going to try my best to also try to incorporate this into getting some sponsors to sponsor this part of the show for the people who donate to our broadcast, and you know, try to get some cool stuff to give out as prizes. And I, from what I understand, that should be pretty easy to do. So I'm going to be working on that. But here we go tonight. This week, our Global Reality All-Stars, Paul in the Netherlands, Michael from the North. I guess he's changed his moniker now. He's Michael from the North. I am Connor McLeod from the Clan McLeod, and I am immortal, and I cannot die. That's what it turns me of, you know. I am Michael from the North. Captain Paul, yet again, and Thomas, Yancey, Andre, and Matthew, a.k.a. Swabs77. So those are our Global Reality All-Stars for the week. Congratulations, gentlemen. Thank you for your support, and thank you for believing in my broadcast and my work and helping me be able to continue. I could not do this without each and every one of you. So regardless of who wins the prize at the end of the month, you are all winners, and I want you all to be recognized by our audience because you are the reason I'm doing this, and you're the reason I'm able to do this. And that's the honest truth. And so this is what I want to continue to keep doing, having our All-Stars, having, you know, I mean, I know it's not much, but look, you know, I want to try to find some way at least every month to show you guys, you know, how much you mean to me and how much your support means to me. And that's why I'm passionate about this. And that's why I have to stay on asking people to support our work, because, you know, if I don't, we don't get the support we need, and then I can't get to work, and then I'm not happy. I'm fucking absolutely miserable. If I can't work and do this work, and I'm not doing, I'm fucking absolutely miserable. But then when I'm, you know, able to get back to work and we get some support, I'm, you know, it's boom, I'm fucking on it, dude. And I'm finding new stuff, and it's just, I'm on fire. So that's what I want it to continue to be. You know, if I didn't have to worry about this every month, my goodness, you want to talk about on fire. Be cranking out stuff left and right. So there you go, Global Reality All-Stars of the Week. Still have another week to go, and you can get in on that as well at theglobalreality.com, the newly designed website up there. Go there and check out everything we got up there. Lots of stuff to do and lots of stuff to see. Lots of news articles up there and stuff as well. Lots of info. And, man, I've got, you know, I've been doing the show for almost 5 years now, so I've been pretty prolific in 5 years. I've put out a lot of info. A lot. There's been, I mean, people post stuff of mine, still post radio shows of mine on, you know, social networking sites that I did 4 years ago, 2008, you know, early shows. People still posting it because I've just continually, you know, just continued to bring information constantly, and I hate repeating myself. So, you know, there's a lot of good stuff throughout the years, throughout a lot of the shows I've done. You can also go to archive.org. Archive.org has the a lot of edited down shows, the past shows I've done. The TuneIn Radio app on iPhone and iPad works to stream the radio network. So you can do that way. So lots of ways to listen. TheGlobalReality.com. If you'd like to send an email to me anytime or during the show, you have comments, questions, something you'd like me to read on the air and address, it's a lot easier. Sometimes you have questions. If you send me an email and you have questions and I don't send you an email back, you need to be listening to the radio show because there's probably a good chance that I'm going to answer that question on the show. Now, if you ask a question and I don't respond to it or you don't hear me read your email, you can try again. You can say, I'm sending this the second time. If you don't hear back from me after the second time, I would just assume it's something, you know, I'm not even going to, like, fucking talk about because it's so ridiculous or whatever, but GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. You also join us in the chat room, Global Reality Chat Room. It's open right now at my website, TheGlobalReality.com. There's all kinds of people in there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, talking it up. So you can always find somebody in there to talk to generally. Not a lot of news again tonight, so we'll burn through what we do have, and we'll get on to our reading here. How's that sound? Where to start tonight? Where to start? Let's just start with this one because it's so ridiculous. If this isn't a symbol, if this isn't a sign, I don't know what is. My goodness, the symbology of this is just symbology buffet. Christ turns green at UN Earth Summit. So they lit up the statue of Christ at the UN Earth Summit to make, you know, for the greeny meanies and stuff. Jesus would want you to be an environmentalist wacko working for Greenpeace and global government. Look, we all know we're supposed to do and what we're not supposed to do. But they try to put all this on us and not the big corporations and these money-grubbing priest-class assholes that run this show. Green guru James Lovelock was right. He warned last week that the green religion was now taking over the Christian religion. Now at the UN Earth Summit, even the image of Christ has been made a forcible convert to the eco-faith as the city of Rio is bathing in the iconic statue of Christ the Redeemer in green light. It's just hilarious. But of course, you know, they do that to embolden one side and enrage the other and just keep the dialectic going. What more can I say about it? That's, you know, that's what it does. Some of these I'm going to burn through fast tonight. Others I'll get into extensively. The Transportation Security Administration already shares intelligence it collects with airports. Now a House bill would expand TSA's intel sharing to local mass transit systems as well. So this is interesting. They're apparently now there's a bill to try and get the same TSA, you know, grab your junk security stuff on local mass transit. We're talking about your local subways, your local bus route, you know, whatever. But here in Dallas, we have the DART system, which is Dallas Area Rapid Transit. And they run both buses and these train, tram things, high-speed rail. And so, you know, if what this bill proposes is that now instead of being able to, go down the street from where I live and get on the train and, you know, go downtown, go to downtown Dallas and, you know, do some stuff and then come back home, you know, home and get on the train and come right back and be home again. They're going to make it where, you know, you're going to go through the same TSA style checkpoints before you even get on local mass transit like a bus. Now, this is something they've been going for a while, and I've predicted for years that there's going to be a 9/11 style event that happens not only with the freeways and interstate systems and lock those down further, but also with the local mass transit subways. We're probably going to see a subway terrorist attack that's staged by the power elite. We'll probably see, you know, any number of these things. But of course, the reason I'm covering this story is because if something like that does happen, it's going to be very important to look at all the details surrounding it because of this bill now that they're passing preemptively to give the TSA the power to patrol your local bus stop or your local high-speed rail or whatever you have in your city or your local subway system. Representative Jackie Speier, the bill's sponsor, said the legislation is a common-sense approach to fighting terrorism. It's common sense. The House passed the bill May 30th, and the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs is now considering the bill. So it's already passed the House. More zombie news. Can't get enough of that, I know. It seems like nobody can. People just go nuts over zombies, man. I've never understood it. And, you know, I said it once, I'll say it again. The zombie apocalypse has been here for a long time. I don't know what y'all are fucking, you know, I don't know where y'all are living, but I see the zombie apocalypse every day. I go outside. I seriously. You walk outside, see somebody. Fucking mouth breathing, dragging their fucking foot across the road. I mean, seriously, you're like, oh, goddamn, is that a zombie? No, it's just a person. We've all been dumbed down to such a level. We all look like zombies. And people are just getting dumber. Saw a guy coming out of 7-Eleven today. And I opened the door for him, but he goes, thank you. And this guy didn't look like he was retarded. He looked, you know what I mean? So some people... They, you know, the curtains match the drapes, so to speak. They, you know, they kind of, how they talk is kind of reflects how they look. Well, it wasn't the case with this guy. He's very, you know, he's kind of an older gentleman, maybe in his 50s, but he looked like he was very astute. He's like, thank you. And he wasn't, you know, Down syndrome patient or anything. It was just, I was like, Jesus, man, people are just being dumbed down. But for those, for you gun enthusiasts out there, they finally have made you the perfect weapon for killing zombies. And, well, it'll be flying off the shelves. Flying off the shelves, I'm sure. The zombie apocalypse will hit us all one day. That's basically a fact. But whether it comes today or 28 days later, these two shop owners from Jonesboro near Atlanta will be ready to deal with any of the area's resident evil when the undead finally arrives. They have created the ultimate zombie gun mounted with 9 30-round magazines, 4 flashlights, 3 lasers to pinpoint out their lumbering targets, and 3 different sightings so they can pick off their targets from 100, 200, or 300 yards away. So if you live near Jonesboro on that fateful night of the living dead, head to Moss Jewelry and Guns for some protection from Barry and Fred. That's just fucking... It's not even right. Oh, man. That's just greatness. But, you know, the problem is that, there's plenty of zombies out there now. Problem is you can't shoot any of them and take you to jail. They have to be, you know, they have to have at least feasted on some brains before it's okay to shoot them. I mean, well, in some states it's not, but in my state where I live, it is. I mean, in my state, if a fucking zombie's already eating some brains and he's dragging foot, dragging ass towards you, acting like he's about to eat yours, it is legal to pop him. I mean, it's protection. So there you go. Bear that in mind. And we do have more bath salt news. I'm completely convinced this is coming as a result. This is some sort of, I think that this, bath salt thing definitely has a connection with the fluoride reduction. And if you know, I mean, you know, not to be classist, but I mean, have you been following this and seen the pictures of these people who've been on these bath salts? I mean, they none of them to me look like the type that's drinking fucking, you know, Perrier or, you know, they're not sipping on fucking Fiji water or something like that at $3 a bottle. No, they're fucking sipping tap, motherfucker. This shit's straight fucking fluoride Chinese ridden tap. And shit, most of the bottled water is too anyway. I mean, they just triple osmosis filter it or whatever and charcoal filter the shit out of it and pop it through. I mean, Dasani is, you know, fucking tap water from the Atlanta tap water system. Mmm, Hotlanta. Hot water from Hotlanta, just what I want. Mmm. And there's a fucking benzene plastic fucking encrusted bottle, too. Yummy stuff. But really, I don't think that, I don't think any of these bath salt victims so far have been sipping on Perrier or anything. A woman who destroyed a painting worth $40 million has spoken out about her shameful act, claiming it to have been high on bath salts when she did it. Carmen Tisch was arrested after surveillance footage captured her pawing at a painting at the Clifford Still Museum in Denver, Colorado, before turning around and leaning on it as she urinated. So she clawed at a painting and then pissed on it, a $40 million painting? Boy, that's probably not smart. Probably not a good move. Who was the painter? Oh, Jackson, was it? Oh, no, it wasn't Jackson Pollock, was it? Something still? Huh. But, yeah. Something tells me she was sipping on the tap. Just as the zombie threat appears to finally be lifting, it seems America could be at the mercy of an even deadlier menace. A mob of leprechauns are carrying out vicious attacks in and around the city of Seattle, according to a man who claims to be one of their latest victims. I'm not joking about this. This is really in the news. I'm not making this up. You couldn't make this kind of stuff up. I wouldn't just get up here and tell you that fucking leprechauns were attacking people if they weren't. Jesus. I mean, what in the fuck is going on with this world? I'm starting to get the impression, and maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. Tell me if you guys see this. But I'm starting to get the impression that, you know how, remember in Tron, how the computer world starts wanting to come in into the real world and do stuff in the real world and take it over? I think that that has happened. I think we've officially hit that level. I think that memes, internet memes, have now officially jumped over from cyberspace and now have infiltrated our mainstream real world non-internet culture and spread like a virus to the point that memes, such as zombies and, you know, leprechauns or whatever it may be, memes have now become a source of constant entertainment. A mob of leprechauns are carrying out vicious attacks in and around the city of Seattle, according to a man who claims to be one of their latest victims. The pint-sized brutes were allegedly hopping mad after catching the man dancing with the wrong girl at a Belltown bar. Officers arrived at the scene of the bar fight to find the man covered in blood and screaming in pain with his head held in his hands. When officers asked who attacked him, the man replied, "It was a bunch of leprechauns." Jesus Christ, fucking dogs and cats living together, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, the works. Zombies, leprechauns, Christ. I mean, you better be fucking armed. According to the victim, one of his assailants was wearing a white tank top. There are no additional reports of Mary Jigs turning ugly or stolen pots of gold. The man was taken to Harborview Medical Center with multiple head injuries, cuts and bruises on his face, back, knuckles, and elbows. Police were apparently unable to find the leprechauns or anyone else involved in the attack. And, of course, they have released a picture to the press on what he may look like. And I'll drop it in the chat room for you. Oh, it didn't come up. Well, yeah. Safe to say, I think Warwick Davis has an alibi. That's all I wanted to say. That was my only point. You know, I think Warwick Davis definitely has an alibi. Oh, it's fucking ridiculous. People are fucked up in the head these days, even more than they ever have been. It's sad to say. You know, this is a strange, strange story, and I don't know why this caught my eye. I was just going through some news stories, and I saw this story, and it seemed odd to me because of the lack of information. And it seemed like something out of a movie. You know, oftentimes in movies we see these stories where, you know, some person, oftentimes a child or a teenager, is trying to escape from somebody who's after him for a certain reason. And then they put out some story in the media that says, you know, if you've seen this child, please alert authorities immediately. But they don't tell you any reason why they're looking for this child. And I saw a case of this. And I'm going to tell you, man, it's another one of those cases where my gut was just telling me something weird about this. And it's strange, and it could be just pixelation, but in both of these pictures of this child, this teenager, two different pictures, his eyes look strangely, strangely extraterrestrial. I mean, strangely extraterrestrial, and it really just got me thinking, like, man, you know, what if this is like... There he is. Warwick Davis. You know, not only was Warwick Davis the leprechaun, but he was also one of the Ewoks, by the way. But yeah, I just wondered, maybe, you know, what if this kid is some extraterrestrial or something as a teenager and they're looking for him. There's just something very strange about this, and the lack of details. They're being very tight-lipped. Authorities, federal agents are looking for this kid, and everybody's being tight-lipped about not saying why. Who is the boy in the basement? Federal agents appeal for help in identifying mystery teen in serious danger in chilling video. Homeland Security officials say he's in serious danger. Now, why would federal agents, Homeland Security, all this be looking for this kid, and why aren't they telling us why? Why is this kid so high profile? Why does he have all of the federal agents and Homeland Security looking for him? And why aren't they telling us why that is? This is an odd case, folks. Something stinks to high heaven about this. I don't know exactly what, but I dropped the link in the chat room for you guys. Federal agents have launched an extraordinary appeal for the public's help in identifying a mystery teenage boy who appears in an online video and who they believe is in serious danger. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Homeland Security Investigations Unit. Wait a minute. Immigration's involved, too? That means, uh-oh. You know, what are immigration? They look for what? Illegal what? Illegal aliens. Uh-oh. I told you there's some aliens involved here. Well, maybe not those kind, but, you know. I don't know, but look at the pictures of this kid, man. Seriously, this kid looks like he's a freaking alien or something. They say the boy between 13 and 19 is in a dangerous environment with several other children and at least one adult. But the agents remain tight-lipped on the exact circumstances of the boy, refusing to say whether he has been kidnapped, is a victim of a human trafficking ring, or is at risk from pedophiles. In the pictures, the teen appears to be wearing in a basement, age between the 13 and 19. ICE believes that the recording was made within the last 18 months or 2 years based on the design of the boy's T-shirt. We have reason to believe that this person may now live or may have lived at one time in either Minnesota or Western Wisconsin. It's entirely possible this young man is not currently in Minnesota or Wisconsin, but has either a friend or a relative in the area or recently moved from one of those states. It looks like he may be talking to another person, possibly an older person, off camera. We believe there's an adult involved in all this. It is thought that the teen is particularly at risk because he is unable to ask for help from the police. If we can identify the young person involved, we suspect that we may be able to remove a couple of young people from a dangerous environment and so on. Right. Yeah, they really come on. Give me a fucking break, folks. Are you going to buy that? Because I don't buy that for a second. You're telling me Immigration, Customs Enforcement, Homeland Security, and the FBI all just care about getting some teenage boy out of danger? That's their whole motivation here? Give me a break. Something stinks to high heaven about this, and they're lying out of their teeth. They are not going to extend those resources just because some teenage... I mean, there are teenagers, runaways, are in trouble all the time. But do we deploy the FBI and the Immigration and Enforcement Customs Service and Homeland Security for every missing teenage boy that may be in trouble out there? Hell no, we don't. There's something about this. They're looking for this guy for some reason, and they're not telling us why. So this is just bizarre, bizarre, bizarre. It is not usual for ICE to issue a public appeal, but they hope the public will be able to identify the boy and help him if he is at risk. Right. This is not our normal way of doing things, but we'll do it this time. Right. They're lying. There's something up with this. This summer, coming to a juicy vein on you, the blood-sucking, stinging critter set to make your life an itchy hell. It may sound like a line from a horror movie trailer, but be warned. The sun is out and so are the bugs, marching with a vengeance all over the U.S. Yeah, they are, aren't they? Goddamn, it's fucking mosquito hell here in fucking Dallas, man. You can't go outside and smoke a cigarette for fucking 5 minutes without getting beat the fuck up by mosquitoes, dude. It's ridiculous. Ants, cockroaches, ticks, bees, and the dreaded Asian tiger mosquito are flying and crawling in force thanks to a mild winter and a mellow spring. New Orleans, along with many other sites or cities in the northeast Illinois, has already reported a larger number of mosquitoes this year. Yeah, fuck yeah, here too. And what's funny is, this Asian tiger mosquito, this very one that's in this picture, that's black and white, that's what I've been seeing. And it just makes me wonder if people just have already forgotten, and it's already gone down the memory hole, that this was the exact breed that was genetically modified and released by Bill Gates at the 2008 TED conference, live on stage. Anybody else but me think that that's too coincidental? Considering the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation connection to eugenics out the ass. In 2008, he lets these genetically modified mosquitoes go at the TED conference. And then, you know, here we are 4 years later. And all of a sudden, there's just an outbreak of these things. And especially with all this new technology they have, man, you better get some fucking off and some citronella candles going quick if you live in the United States like I do. Dozens of scientists, artists, and entertainers are gathering in Silicon Valley this weekend to discuss the search for intelligent aliens and humanity's place in the universe. Yeah, I think they're getting close to rolling this out soon. They're coming for SETICON 2, which runs Friday to Sunday, June 22nd to 24th in Santa Clara, California. The meeting was organized by SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, which is based in nearby Mountain View. SETICON 2's main goal is to explore our place in space and future of the search for alien life, conference organizers said. So this is, it's funny, it's interesting, they're ramping up this extraterrestrial thing, and then also at the same time they're also ramping up this science versus religion debate and putting it in movies and putting it out there because, you know, they're getting ready to shift some stuff around, and it's going to be interesting to see how many people live and survive and how many people can't handle the real truth, you know, or whatever truth it is they present to us, whether it's real or not. Archaeologists have uncovered the foundation of what appears to have been a massive ancient structure, possibly a bridge leading to an artificial island in what is now southeast Wales. The strange ruin, its discoverers say, is unlike anything found before in the United Kingdom and possibly all of Europe. Wow. It's a real mystery, said Steve Clark, chairman and founding member of the Monmouth Archaeological Society, who discovered the structural remains earlier this month in Monmouth, Wales, a town known for its rich archaeological features. Whatever it is, there's nothing else like it. It may well be unique. Clark and his team discovered the remnants of three giant timber beams placed alongside one another on a floodplain against the edge of an ancient lake that has long since been filled with silt. After being set into the ground, the pieces of timber decayed, leaving anaerobic oxygen-free clay, which formed after silt filled in the timbers, empty slots. The team initially thought the timber structures were once sleeper beams or shafts of timber placed in the ground to form the foundations of a house. However, the pieces appear to be too large for that purpose. While a typical sleeper beam would span about 1 foot across, these timber beams were over 3 feet wide and at least 50 feet long. The archaeologists are still digging and don't yet know how much longer the timbers are. Clark says the structure builders appear to have placed whole trees cut in half lengthwise into the ground. One other thing that is striking that might be relevant is that the timbers seem to be lined up with the middle of the lake. Yep, there's an alignment for you. Clark noted, suggesting that the structures may have been part of a causeway to a crannog or an artificial island constructed in the middle of the lake. Even so, it's a path to a crannog. It's hope. The archaeologists also aren't sure when it was built or even if it came before or the lake was formed, but they say the structure and its oldest could date to the Bronze Age around 4,000 years ago. There you go. There's our Amorite boys again. Beneath the beams, the researchers found a burnt mound of rock and charcoal fragments, alongside of which they discovered a hearth and a trough. Scientists believe people in the Bronze Age heated stones in fire and then threw them into a filled trough to boil water. The discovery of this unusual site on a housing development near Monmouth is very interesting. We've been monitoring the situation closely. At this point, the date and function of the structure represented by these three long trenches is not known. Despite a great deal of speculation, only further excavation can be clarified to exactly what they represent. Clark believes it's more likely the structure was built a little later, possibly during the Iron Age, but he says determining a reliable age for the structure will be tricky. Dating the burnt mound, which predates the timber that was placed on top of it, will only give a maximum age for the structure. Dating the clay, on the other hand, will yield an age that is too young because the clay deposited after the timber rotted away. All those tricky dating problems. Stonehenge was built to unify Britain's warring tribes, it is claimed after decade-long study. And that's the thing is, these guys can't wrap their minds around the fact that Stonehenge or this place in Wales and all these different things, all built by the same race of people. Stonehenge was built to cement a new east-west alliance between the former warring tribes of Britain as the country started to become a united kingdom after centuries of strife, it has been claimed. The findings come after 10 years of work by experts who rejected ideas that it was influenced by extraterrestrials or ancient Egypt, or was even linked to the summer solstice, which attracts modern pagans. My God! So it's not in any way, shape, or form aligned to the solstices. Okay. All right, you're right. You're right, and people with fucking two eyes and a brain are wrong. Yeah, as usual. Scientists have also rejected notions that the monument was a prehistoric observatory, a sun temple, a place of healing, or a temple of the ancient druids. The stones, they believe, symbolize the ancestors of the various clans, early farming families. Right. Yeah, they didn't have the fucking means or the wherewithal to erect stones like that. Give me a goddamn break. More disinformation on the front of Stonehenge because, again, the real truth's coming out. And, sorry, gotta be frank, these bitches are scared. They're bottom line. They know what's coming. And, you know, I gotta say, I've noticed something, and I would be remiss not to mention it, or at least say this. A couple things, you know, I sometimes get to thinking about certain things, and they're interesting, and sometimes you don't have anybody to talk to it about, so, and it, you know, it pertains to this, so, you know, you just want to come and bring it to the radio show, but, you know, I've noticed, it kind of got me thinking about, I've noticed that there are certain individuals out there who seem to really support my work and be behind me when I was talking about the secret right stuff and the CMP stuff 24/7. That's all I was talking about getting into. And then after I quit talking about that anymore, because to me it's like, you know, I mean, yeah, it's important, but I've got other stuff I want to do. I've got more battles to fight here, and you know, to get stuck in one topic or something, that's just not me. You know, I like to take a topic and dedicate myself to it for a long time, or as long as it needs. But the thing about the current topic is, I mean, this, you know, this is not just one topic. This is many, 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 because we're talking about sites and places and things all over the planet. But I think that there are a lot of people who, I'm just going to say it, I think there were a lot of people out there who were like, I don't know, disinformation agents, or people who had an interest in creating division and stuff like that within the truth movement and the patriot movement. Now, see, that was never my intent. Although I've been accused of that many times, I never had the intent that I was going to, you know, disrupt or, you know, be any sort of a debunker against the truth movement or anything like that. But I also couldn't sit back and sit on my hands and not call out things that needed to be called out concerning these people and their very connections to the very people they claim to expose. But I think a lot of people misinterpreted that and, you know, liked it because I was pissing in there, you know, in the pot of the truth movement or whatever, and because they have a grudge against it for whatever their own personal reasons or whatever. But it's just funny that, there's certain people that I you know, that who don't you know, support my work, don't donate, and don't come around the chat rooms anymore. You know, once I quit talking about all that stuff, and you know, I just think that's sad. It says something, you know, it just says a lot about those people like that, that can't evolve and see how this ties into the big picture. Because all the stuff I'm getting into now ties just as much into the big picture and ties just as much into exposing the phonies as anything I've ever done. And if you can't see that, then you're not seeing it in the right way. You're not allowing yourself to see it in the right way. But, you know, I wanted to put that out there. Also, another thing that I was thinking about, and, you know, sometimes, you know, there is a tendency, sometimes people can make connections in places that where, you know, connections shouldn't be made and stuff doesn't fit. And then it makes it more difficult for people like me who are bringing out, you know, insane connections to things that, you know, most people don't consider to be even relevant, but they are once you research them. And then that, you know, that sort of muddies the water for people like me. But there are people who make connections with information and things that just, you know, not, I mean, so, yes, almost everything is connected, but there are some things that just don't connect sometimes. But on the flip side of that, there are things that do connect that sometimes we miss because we go, oh, no, you know, there's no way that'd be possible. That's got to be just a coincidence, you know. But I was thinking about back in, you know, from back in 2008, the original Obama campaign and the slogan, you know, yes, we can. And everything was, yes, we can. Yes, we can. All right. Yes, we can. Are we going to get me elected because I'm black? Yes, we can. And it always kind of stuck in my craw from day one, the first day I heard that, because, you know, if you weren't from Dallas, you wouldn't know this. But if you are from Dallas, you'll know this, and you'll think it's funny. But also, maybe it's not just funny. Maybe there is something to it. I don't know. Something really wrapped my head around it. It's just something I was thinking about. There is a car dealership here in Dallas. It's been here for years and years and years. And this particular car dealership, one of their slogans for years has been, yes, we can. You know, can we get you in a new car today? Yes, we can. That's been, you know, that's been their thing for years and years and years and years. And what's interesting about that, and the fact that, you know, Obama used that as his campaign slogan, is that the particular car dealership that we're discussing here is W.O. Bankston. Now, what's interesting about that is W.O. Bankston is, a lot of people probably have, you know, who lived in Dallas in the past 30, 40 years probably think W.O. Bankston is just the name of a car dealership in Dallas, you know. Probably a lot of people in Dallas driving around cars that were bought at W.O. Bankston. But if you're somebody like me who spends all his time researching, you know things like the fact that W.O. Bankston is not just the name of a car dealership. It's also the name of a very high-level right-wing Freemason, wealthy individual who was one of the individuals that met the night before the Kennedy assassination at the so-called Clinton Murchison meeting. Clint Murchison was another high-level guy. These guys were the rich oil barons that preceded the CMP. They had a group called the Sweet 8F Group. And the Sweet 8F Group, if you can find any information on them, is a, and I plan on doing some more stuff in the future when I do more Secret Ride installments, to do some more stuff on the Sweet 8F Group and on the Arlington Group as well. But the Sweet 8F Group was this sort of this precursor to the CMP stuff. And W.O. Bankson was a high-level Freemason in Dallas and a very wealthy individual. And he was one of the individuals that was there, you know, the night when LBJ allegedly came out, told his mistress, you know, after tomorrow, those goddamn Kennedys are never going to embarrass us again. So I thought it was interesting with all this stuff, you know, like fucking Richard Hoaxland's come out with about all the good Freemasons that are on our side are working with Obama in the background to help bring him up because he's the Messiah and I can prove it with quantum physics. I mean, what a joke. But there has been a lot of Masonic iconography used around Obama, specifically with his campaign in 2008. They had his logo that looked like a winged disc, you know, a winged disc of Horus, Egyptian thing. So there has been a lot of iconography and a lot of connections there. And again, you know, I don't know if there's any connection to that. I don't know if that's a connection that you can even make and if that even means anything or not. But it's, my head is constantly full of those things, man. And oftentimes I don't get up here and voice those. And I want to try to do that more because, you know, whether or not it means anything or not, you just never know what little tidbit you're going to throw out there that somebody else is going to hear that's going to resonate with something else they already know to be true. So, yeah, there you go. I mean, I thought that was very, it's like W.O. Bankson, yes, we can. You know, there's, and I wonder if that yes, we can, I bet you a dollar to donuts that if somebody was to do, you know, like anagrams analysis on yes, we can, or gematria analysis on that, I bet you'd probably find some very interesting things. Glass jewelry believed to have been made by Roman craftsmen has been found in an ancient tomb in Japan. Researchers said Friday, in a sign that the empire's influence may have reached the edge of Asia. Tests have revealed three glass beads discovered in the 5th century Yutsukushi burial mound in Nagagoka near Kyoto were probably made sometime between the 1st and 4th century. The government-backed institute has recently finished analyzing the components of the glass beads, measuring 5 millimeters in diameter. It found that the light yellow beads were made with natron, a chemical used to melt glass by craftsmen in the empire, which succeeded the Roman Empire in 27 BC and was ultimately ended by the fall of Constantinople in 1453. The beads, which have a hole through the middle, were made with a multi-layering technique, a relatively sophisticated method in which the craftsman piled up layers of glass, often sandwiching gold leaf in between. They are one of the oldest multi-layered glass products found in Japan and very rare accessories that were believed to be made in the Roman Empire and sent to Japan. So again, more ancient craftsmanship found in tombs that exceeds what people should have had during the times. Very interesting stuff there. Well, that does it for our news tonight. We are going to take a break, musical interlude for you here tonight, and come back and get into our continued series of reading. Next week is our fundraising week for the bills. Got to pay the bills for the month, so please help us out and make a donation there at the website, theglobalreality.com, and show your support for our work, and you'll find everything else pertaining to my work up there. at my website as well, theglobalreality.com. We're going to take a break, come back, and get into more for you here tonight. This is The Global Reality. Stay with us.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. Friday night. It is the weekend, isn't it? Are you guys glad it's a weekend? Ready to relax, chill out, have a cold one or something, relax. Yeah. Well, if you're chilling out, relaxing, getting ready to start your weekend or getting ready to start your work day, whatever it may be, thanks for being with us. We're going to continue on tonight, Chapter 31, in our series of reading Prehistoric Aviators of the Andes. Again, my website, theglobalreality.com. Next week is our fundraiser, and we got about $900 to go to pay the bills for the month. And I think roughly something like, I haven't crunched the numbers, but I think it's something like 14 or 15 people. I want to say it's like, 14 or 15, something like that. 14 or 15 people at at $50 each will get it done. So if we can get 14 people between now and this time next Friday, or now and next Friday, 14 people between now and then to donate $50 each, we will have the bills paid for them. I think that's right. Let me crunch that real quick just to make sure. Actually, no, that's not correct. 14 is not correct. It'd actually be 18, I think. So 18 people at 50 bucks. That's still doable. I mean, my God, we have 300,000 listeners in the past month. We can't get 15 people to donate or 18 people to donate $50 between now and next Friday. Come on. I don't believe that. We can do that. And I'd love to be sitting here next week and reading off, not only reading off 18 names for the Global Reality All-Stars, but also putting 18 more names in the hat for the prize. And I will tell you this. If we do get 18 pledges between now and next Friday to get the bills paid for the month, I will up the ante and double the prize for the drawing for the Global Reality All-Stars for this month only. I will double it up, and we will give not one, but two prizes away. So, definitely keep that in mind and support our work at theglobalreality.com so we can pay the bills of the month. Chapter 31, Prehistoric Aviators of the Andes. Our readers know that the Wright brothers were the first men to fly a heavier-than-air craft, but another set of brothers, Jacques and Joseph Montgolfier, are credited with having successfully piloted the earliest hot air balloon in late 18th century France. Virtually every chronology of aviation is based on these two historic facts. One of them, however, is a fallacy. Aircraft aficionados are mostly unaware that the first fully documented human flight took place 74 years before the Montgolfier brothers. The true honor instead goes to Bartholomew de Gusamau, pronounced Gushamau. On August 8, 1709, he readied a small skiff made of woven reeds attached by thin, sturdy cords to a huge triangular envelope made of cotton and paper. When fully inflated, resembled an irregular pyramid. John V, King of Portugal, watched with his assembled court and a great crowd of spectators as a small fire filled the envelope with smoke. Gushmau hopped aboard La Passerola, the Sparrow, which to the amusement of spectators on the ground rose vertically and majestically to about 60 feet in the air, then drifted with a mild wind more than a mile from Lisbon Castle of St. George to the House of India. Landing gently on the lawn of the Colonel office to wide popular acclaim and royal favor, The pilot was hailed as El Voyador, the flying man. King John personally granted him a patent for La Passerola, the military potential of which was even then apparent by its debut, which was recorded by Vatican archives as the first successful flight in human history. But El Voyador's glory was short-lived, as was he himself. Hounded by politically powerful religious fanatics who condemned his invention as a blasphemous device of the devil that enabled sinful man to storm heaven, Guzmán fled to Toledo, Spain, where he died impoverished and forgotten at age 38. Not until the advent of the Wright brothers' first heavier-than-air flight was the Portuguese flying man's achievement rediscovered, ironically enough, by French researchers who found a conflicting claim to the world's first aviation honors held by their own national heroes, the Montgolfier brothers. The story of 1709's previously neglected exploit became so popular that the Aeronautical Academy of Bartolomeu de Guzmão flourished in Paris from the turn of the century through 1920s. Until the economic crash of 1929, its members raised substantial funds for commission of a large monument, then shipped it to his Brazilian birthplace, where it stands to this day, neglected. An elaborate bronze plaque commemorating the flight shows a large triangular-shaped balloon flying over old Lisbon. Beneath are inscribed the words, "The empire of the skies was reserved for the gods until it was conquered by man on August 8, 1709. That's interesting. The empire of the sky was reserved for the gods? Yeah, flying around in their ships. That's an interesting thing to be on a statue, isn't it? See, the guys at the highest levels, it's just a fact to them. Academy members underwrote two additional memorials, one in Lisbon to honor the date and place of the Sparrow's inaugural flight, the other in Toledo at the Aero Pioneer's grave. They even had a medal struck to celebrate the bicentennial of his unprecedented achievement. The Academy could not survive the worldwide financial depression of the 1930s, however, and turbulent events of the following decade consigned Guzmán once again to oblivion, except for a commemorative stamp issued by the Brazilian government in 1944. Not until 33 years later was his fame resurrected by an American balloonist, James Woodman, whose work in South American archaeology brings us to a far greater mystery than the disregard still surrounding his 18th-century predecessor's singular accomplishment, with which it is nonetheless strangely linked. During the early 1970s, Woodman became fascinated with the so-called Nazca Lines, the largest art gallery on Earth. This collection of outsized designs, some geometric, others portraying a variety of animals, was created by removing dark gray top cover to reveal faint yellow sand just beneath the Peruvian desert. Uncertainly bracketed with the perimeters of the 3rd century BC and 5th century AD, pre-Inca Nazca civilization is poorly understood by archaeologists. Their only clues are vividly decorated pottery remnants, massive sophisticated subterranean aquifers associated with its people, and colossal geoglyphs scattered across the arid plain. These images were not discovered until the early 1930s and then by accident, when a local pilot happened to fly over the figures, which had gone unnoticed until then. All are superbly executed in perfect proportion, some several miles in length, demonstrating an exceptionally high degree of skill in surveying techniques, social cooperation, and the ability to accurately transfer artwork from normal-sized sketches to a gigantic scale. The Nazca Lines were popularized by Eric von Daniken, the ancient astronaut theorist who insisted that they had been laid out many thousands of years ago by visitors from another planet as runways for spaceships. Although Woodman dismissed this juvenile fantasy, he nonetheless believed that the pteroglyphs could only be appreciated from an aerial perspective. At the other extreme, mainstream scholars assume that they were sacrificial offerings only, not made to be seen by their creators, but meant for viewing exclusively by the gods who lived in the sky. I love how they can't see that that's one and the same. Idiots. Such conventional speculation, as baseless as it is unconvincing, did not sit well with Woodman, who was unable to shake off the logical, no less officially impossible conclusion that the ancient South Americans had somehow achieved manned flight. the only means by which they could observe their gargantuan art tableau spread across the Peruvian desert. It did not make sense to him that they should have gone to the immense trouble of executing such a large collection, only to deny themselves any opportunity of ever seeing it. No matter how deep their devotion to the gods, the very notion seemed contrary to fundamental human nature, regardless of cultural and temporal differences separating our times from the prehistoric Nazca. Woodman began researching possibilities, however unlikely, for pre-Columbian aviation, an investigation that led him to the forgotten story of Bartolomé de Gushmau, a no less mysterious figure, it turned out, than El Vorador's own early 18th century balloon. Born 1685 in Brazil of Portuguese parents, Gushmau was educated at his native city of Santos by Jesuit fathers. It's so crazy. I did not know that. In fact, I don't know if I've ever even heard of this Gushmau guy before, but I don't know what it was when I was reading that part a minute ago when they said that they mentioned Eric von Daniken being, you know, the guy talking about the Nazca lines, and all I could get in my head was that clip of von Daniken from Coast to Coast AM where he says, "And yes, I was trained by the Jesuits." So isn't that an interesting coincidence that somehow this Gushmau guy, the story of him is somehow connected to these ancient aviators of Brazil, and he would be Jesuit trained just as von Daniken is. Very, very interesting stuff. And again, when you see the connections to this ancient alien stuff and this the people who seem to be the experts having extensive ties to the order. The Jesuit trains, they train agents. And they train their agents not to be out and outwardly appear that they are working for the priest class, but they indeed are. But part of their training, part of the Jesuit training, is training them to be good actors. And it's funny when you look at how many actors, you know, there are connected. I mean, from Charlie Sheen, and what about that clip I have where Alex Jones' own wife says, "Oh, he's a great actor," and he just happens to be friends with, you know, Hutton Gibson, Mel Gibson's father, former Jesuit priest. On and on and on with the connections. Of course, he's had John McManus on. John McManus was Jesuit trained as well. So always these connections to, you know, conspiracy stuff and all this and ancient alien stuff with these priest class Jesuit guys. He complemented his advanced education with them at their seminary in Belém, where he excelled in languages, mathematics, and physics. It is important to understand that the Jesuits were great explorers of Brazil and the rest of South America. Motivated by missionary zeal, they traveled throughout the continent where no modern Europeans had ever gone before. Right. Under the guise of going there to, you know, oh, they're going on a mission, they're missionarying, you know, going down and trying to spread the word, the gospel. Bullshit. Those guys were on expeditions to find knowledge and to find artifacts, just like everybody else that does those expeditions is. They do it under the guise of, you know, missionary work. That's bullshit. It is all missionary work from the Catholic Church has always been a front to set up these and find these artifacts that may, you know, present themselves as a problem to their religious hierarchy. The Catholic Fathers studied native myths, customs, and behavior, then passed the information on to their students as aids to successful evangelism. As part of his schooling, Gushmau not only heard cultural news from the friars, but participated in several jungle expeditions himself. Either during one of these missionary forays or from veteran Jesuit accounts, young Bartolomé learned some very peculiar details about the natives of the rainforest. Oh, shit. Motherfucker. Y'all seeing where this is going? So this guy, wow, that's telling, isn't it? That's a microcosm for the much larger stuff with the Jesuits I've been screaming about for almost 5 years now. Because this guy goes on these missionary expeditions to, to Peru and Brazil. Somewhere along the way, he comes into some ancient knowledge. And what's he do? He takes this ancient knowledge, applies it, and becomes the first man to fly. All with information he gained from these people who had advanced knowledge. So that right there, folks, is very telling and very much proves what I've been saying for years and years and years, is that these quote-unquote missionaries are never on a mission to spread the gospel. They were there to gain information, to use, and to absorb into their priest class, and then report back to their masters, and the masters and war generals who are in the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. And you think it's a coincidence that all the people that were funding Contras for the eradication of the indigenous populations there to take and spread Christianity to them, you think it's a coincidence that all the people involved in Iran-Contra, from Oliver North to Pat Buchanan to Larry Pratt and on and on and on, all just happen to be members of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta? Not a coincidence at all. The Jesuits, that's why the Jesuits are kind of, they're not the guys getting their hands dirty. There's a clip in Secret Volume 2 that's very telling, and that's exactly in my research what I've found. These guys are the brains. They're not the brawn. The Jesuits are the brains. They're the information holders. They're the knowledge keepers. They're the ones that formulate plans and plans of action and strategies that serve the agenda. And the Sovereign Military Order of Malta is the end that executes said plans. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So this guy goes and learns all this stuff from the natives and becomes the first man to fly. Huh. So what's that say about the information that these natives had? Far more important than just a bunch of savages, I'd say, don't you? But again, where'd they get it from? And, you're going to find that out once my Volume 1 of The Lost Secrets of Ancient America is done. So, again, please help us to get this done. Very important work. Every time I read more and more of this book, it just feels like not in a bad way, but it just feels like another weight on my shoulder. Like, man, you got your cut out for you here. Not in a bad way. I got this. Don't worry about it. As long as I get the support I need, I got this down. But man, it's just so much info, and trying to absorb it all and process it, and then also trying to make it and put it in a film. It kind of takes me some time to sort of absorb all this before I can just take it and make it work in the film, because you got to make sure it fits in with everything else that you've already been researching and doing. So it's, as I've described before, it's like making a film is like taking a 10 million piece jigsaw puzzle, throwing all the pieces up in the air and, trying to put it together. These were, he was told that several otherwise backward tribes in Brazil and Peru were skilled in the manufacture of curious objects. They were 5 foot tall envelopes of paper that could fly, filled with smoke rising from small clay pots of smoldering cane, suspended underneath a single opening. The contraptions actually rose into air of their own accord. When questioned by the astounded friars, the Indians explained that the little hot air balloons comprised a legacy for their most ancient ancestors and were flown only for religious purposes, bringing small offerings to the sky gods. In spring 1709, Gushmal appeared in Lisbon with his own flying model. Because of its successful performance before a royal committee, the Jesuit priest from Brazil was financially encouraged to proceed with the completion of a full-size version that carried him aloft for the first time a few months later. When Woodman learned of this lost achievement, he was particularly intrigued as an archaeologist. See, he goes and finds it. They go on this supposed mission. Oh, we're going to go do missionary work to the ancient tribes. No. They go and do missionary work. He brings back this knowledge of how to make this flying machine. Brings it back, makes it works, and then what's the first thing that is said to him as soon as he lands on the ground? I read it earlier in the chapter. As soon as he lands on the ground, just as you would expect, the first thing out of the first person's mouth that he sees is, oh boy, wow, think about the military applications of this. So boom, again, that would go into the hands of the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, the Knights of Malta. See how this is done? It's no different today. It's no different today. They're the brains. The Jesuits are the brains. The Knights of Malta are the brawn. And the White Pope, Vatican stuff is all the front, you know, front man distraction horse shit. That's all it is. The Pope is just there to be the front man like Obama or Bush or anything else. Well, meanwhile, the real power players are in the background. They're not on TV. They're not out, you know, talking to the flock. They're doing the work. Where did I leave off? When Woodman learned of this lost achievement, he was particularly intrigued as an archaeologist by El Vorador's apparent indebtedness to the Brazilian natives for the triumph of La Pesarola. Further research disclosed that at least one Indian tribe today in residence near the Honduran border still make ceremonial aerostats like those the Portuguese missionaries saw fly 300 years ago. Investigation of Peruvian myth revealed additional clues. The Incas, Woodman discovered, honored a deity they referred to as Oricon, or Orichon, who could fly between heaven and back in a vessel of golden flames, imagery implying a gondola equipped with its fire pot suspended beneath a hot air balloon. Even more suggestive was the ancient Andean hero Artaquai, the boy god who reconnoitered for Incan armies by flying high over battlefields and returning to the emperor with intelligence about army dispositions. The myth of Antarqui lends credence to the possibility that Andean lads, because of their light weight, were used to fly military observation balloons. Boys actually did serve as military observers while strapped to large leather-made kites for Greek armies in the field some 200 years before the advent of Nazca civilization. The first such aerial reconnaissance had been invented by Archites of Tantarum, a philosopher, mathematician, astronomer, statesman, and strategist around 400 BC. The following century, unmanned hot air balloons were being flown over China. It is possible, then, that similar contemporaneous advances in aviation were undertaken by pre-Columbian South Americans. Better known than Antarqui was Contiki Viracocha, the Inca's red-bearded, light-complected, fair-eyed-sounding father who fled as a flood survivor from some natural catastrophe. Yeah, Viracocha. There he is, red beard, light-complected. Seafoam, a reference to his white skin and oceanic origins, probably an Atlantean, allegedly shared the high wisdom of his lost homeland with native peoples to create Andean civilization. Among the cultural gifts he bequeathed was the aerostat, or hot air balloon. A standard image in Nazca art may be a direct reference to, and in fact a symbol for, this gift. The likeness of a sea eagle, or frigate bird, appears as the single most reproduced animal throughout Peru's Pacific coastal pottery remnants. The bird is remarkable for its ability to inflate its gullet to a grotesque size in midair, resembling a balloon in flight. Most Nazca drawings depict birds, likewise suggesting flight. Of these, the most cogent to our investigation is a half-human image, the so-called Owl Man, regarded as one of the oldest bioglyphs. It portrays a standing 98-foot-long anthropomorphic figure with the head of an owl incised into the sloping face of a cliff. Like its companions, the ground drawing may be properly appreciated only from the perspective of altitude at several hundred feet. Its gestures with his right hand lifted toward heaven while its left points toward the earth. It is as though the figure were indicating something integrally important concerning all Nazca lines. If you want to see us properly, you have got to go into the sky. Owlman is a misconceived name, however, because it appears to have been originally associated with a sorceress similarly portrayed on Nazca pottery and still revered by mountain Indians. Often shown holding a San Pedro cactus in her left hand, She was and is worshipped as a supernatural guardian of Highland lagoons where the plant grows. Well, yeah. Hello? Hello? Let me tell you something right now, buddy. You do enough San Pedro cactus, your ass is going to be out there carving fucking shit into the rock, thinking you're talking to the gods, too. Because San Pedro cactus is what they derive mescaline from. That's a fact. I mean, I wouldn't tell you you can go down to Home Depot and buy you a San Pedro cactus for $26 and extract the mescaline out of it, eat it, and trip balls if you really wanted to. But, you know, you could if you were so inclined. I wouldn't suggest it, though. This hallucinogenic cactus, when ingested, makes possible the well-known flight of the shaman. An out-of-body experience shamans use to soar up to the gods for healing and wisdom. Containing mescaline, the San Pedro cactus does indeed produce convincing sensations of flight in anyone who ingests it. Fuck him! If he thought he could fly, he should have started from the ground! Bill Hicks, young man on acid, jumped out of a window today. It's a good point, though. You know, that's always my thing. You know, if you're on hallucinogenic drugs and you are going to try to fly, again, always try to start from the ground, okay? Don't go up on a building. Bad news. Whether the desert drawings imply drug-induced astral projection or balloon flight, an aerial experience related to the glyphs seems suggested. Even non-avian depictions point to a connection with the heavens. The dog and fox, both portrayed on the Nazca plane, were symbolic messengers between divine spirits above in the sky and human worshippers below on the ground. Woodman was especially surprised to find that Quechua, the language spoken by the Incas, actually contains a pre-modern word for balloon maker. Moreover, some surviving examples of pottery recovered from the vicinity of the Nazca geoglyphs portray objects resembling balloons flying across the sky, trailing ropes or streamers. Nazca tapestries housed at Lima's National Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology unquestionably depict humans in flight, either through the agency of hallucinogenic pathogens or via balloons. No, see, I don't think it's either one. I think it represents these sky gods coming down and giving the humans these drugs to communicate with the gods, because there's an intimate connection between these quote unquote gods and drugs of all sorts. You got to understand, folks, down there where that area, Peru, you know what that is, right? That's Blow Central, baby. And the natives were said to have been given the cacao plant from the gods. It was considered to be a drug of the gods. And they have found, you can go Google the cocaine mummies. Go Google that, the cocaine mummies. And they, you know, there again, more ancient people found buried with mass amounts of drugs. So I you know, also the people in South America, the ayahuasca shaman who make the ayahuasca mixture out of DMT, do you know how many different alkaloids and roots and things there are in the jungle? Millions. Do you know what the chances and the odds are of finding the two specific alkaloids you need in a rainforest and a jungle to mix together to make the visionary herb ingredients to make the alkaloids for DMT that are found in ayahuasca? One in quadrillion trillion chances. They got this information from these sky gods, and again, they always present you with one side or the other, and I always find that the one side or the other they present you with is never the truth. They, you know, here the example is, well, this either depicts people tripping balls, or this depicts, you know, humans flying for real, or flying because they're tripping balls. And I think it actually represents these sky gods giving the people these visionary herbs as a communication device. At the Nazca lines themselves, broad patches of scorched earth may still be observed at the intersects of drawings or atop nearby low rises. They are the results of intensely hot fires that burned when Nazca civilization flourished in the area. Woodman wondered if these fires were originally ignited by pre-Columbian aviators to inflate their balloons with hot air. Putting this speculation to the test, Woodman and his colleagues, fellow professional balloonists from the United States, built a hot air balloon designed to resemble Gushmal's sparrow and the deltoid miniature still flown by Andean natives. The American scientists restricted their experiment to materials known to have been used by pre-Inca peoples. These included finely woven textiles, straw ropes, and a reed boat of the kind well known from Bolivia's Lake Titicaca, which served as the most likely gondola. Even the ground fires for providing hot air were stoked only with desert wood close at hand. Nothing belonging to modern times was included in the undertaking. At dawn on November 25, 1975, the massive envelope of Woodman's balloon, Condor 1, inflated with 80,000 cubic feet of smoke, then ascended at 18 feet per second, bearing Woodman and companion aloft to almost 400 feet above the Nazca Plain. From that altitude, the awe-inspiring drawings of a vanished prehistoric race came into perfect perspective and proportion. As Woodman later wrote, "The sun had just cleared the mountains and now flooded the fantastic scene below. Surely, I thought the men who created these lines had to have seen them like this, with the shadows of dawn etching their magnificent art. For those 2 minutes we were alone with Nazca, we had flown back in time as much as we had climbed into the sky. After the 20th century balloonists bumped down to a soft landing in the desert, one of them remarked, 'Up there, just now, I had the feeling we weren't the first ever to have flown with the wind above Nazca.'" Woodman capably demonstrated that the ancient Peruvians could have manufactured and flown a hot air balloon. That they actually did so was not proved, but Condor 1's success, the model aerostats flown for unknown centuries by native South Americans, for whom Gushmao seems to have obtained the prototypes for his balloons, and Andean traditions of human flight, the remains of ancient bonfires of the geoglyphs themselves, and the fact that the lines there may only be properly appreciated from several hundred feet above them, persuasively argue on behalf of Peruvian flight during the ancient past, that a people sophisticated enough to create Andean civilization should have possessed the ability to achieve human flight may lie outside the box of modern archaeology, but appears to be nonetheless true. The Nazca hot air balloons were certainly the privilege of upper-class passengers, perhaps reserved exclusively for royalty. Flights were probably undertaken for religious purposes during important sky-worshipping ceremonies in view of the geoglyphs' apparent astro-spiritual significance. Doubtless such ventures were also regarded as an elite sport. Antiquity's myth likewise appears real enough, and we may believe that boys were indeed used additionally for airborne military reconnaissance by the Nazcans, just as history records they were by their nearly contemporaneous Greeks. Though official critics continue to sell short the abilities of prehistoric man, an ancient astronaut theorist endeavored to deprive him of his early achievements by assigning them to anonymous extraterrestrials, the Wright brothers may not have been the first Americans to have flown at all. So that's the end of Chapter 31. Next time, we'll get into Chapter 32, West Virginia's Ancient Highway to Nowhere. Oh, I can't wait to get into this. I've heard about this before. Then they find one in, like, Pennsylvania, too. Several places. Giant, massive superhighways buried under the ground that they just, you know, don't know how they got there, what they were used for. Interesting stuff, especially with Gushmao and the stuff about the Jesuits and just proving further what my research has been saying for years about the Jesuits being the gatherers of the knowledge, the obtainers of the knowledge. This goes back as well to Weishaupt and his gaining the knowledge from the secret societies and the Freemasons and then taking it back to the Jesuits, and then the Jesuits, you know, giving that information that they're Knights of Malta counterparts would then carry out. Earlier in the show, I was talking about the Yes We Can thing with W.O. Bankston and the Freemason connection there and Obama. Energy in the chat room had mentioned, and I talked about this and played the clip backwards on my show back in 2008. I just forgot about it. You know, as I've said before, boy, I've forgotten more than you'll ever know, boy. You know, it's what the old folks always say. But, I talked about that. So, yeah, there you go. Yes, we when you play the Yes, We Can backwards, or Yes, We Can backwards actually says, thank you, Satan. So, W.O. Bankston, Yes, We Can, thank you, Satan. And the fact that W.O. Bankston was a Freemason Although I've never found any conclusive evidence that the Freemasons worship Satan, certainly there is some stuff relating to Jobulon and Lucifer and stuff, but not the guy in the red pajamas with a pitchfork, which is a construct of fear created by the establishment. But nonetheless, interesting stuff. Thank you, Satan. Yeah, yes, we can. We play that backwards. All right, folks. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. Again, so you know what to do. Support our work, and please help us out. If you haven't donated this week, get in on the All-Stars. Any amount always helps. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you, and we'll see you back here next time. You guys have a great one. Take care.